The R.R. Campbell Writes Cast is brought to you in part by listeners like you. Learn more about the great rewards available to Writes Cast contributors by visiting patreon.com/writescast. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the first ever R.R. Campbell Writes Cast podcast, the podcast where we talk about the craft of writing, how to keep your readers engaged, and how to make it, as personally fulfilling for you as the writer as possible. Today, I am very fortunate to have with me Dan Sciro, author of Rogue Destiny. I'll be talking with him about how to get the most out of your action scenes, how to set them up, and, how to execute them in a way that makes sense for you, your characters, and the story you are trying to tell. So, a big welcome to Dan. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ryan. Any opportunity to day drink and talk about writing is definitely right up my alley. So
yeah, the day drinking is that's a big part of it.
Got to be done.
That's got to be done. Why not? The beer is cold, like we were saying before we started recording. So all right, like we said, the beer is cold, but the action scenes never are. So let's start by talking
That was a segue.
Hey, let's do it. We're keeping it real.
That's good.
Segues are real. In your opinion, I guess, what are the core elements to an action scene, whether it's a battle or a showdown or whatever.
Chase scene, maybe.
Go for it.
Absolutely. I think if you want to just kind of boil it down to maybe like three things to talk about the true core elements, you're probably talking about what I'd first call a framework of verisimilitude. Mm-hmm. You're talking about, of course, the characters, and you're talking about the setting. And I think those are, the core elements. And within those are many kind of sub-elements and, a lot of nuanced things of, I think we'll talk about setting later. Is that correct?
Yeah, we'll touch on all three.
So sure.
However we want to structure it here. But yeah.
So for that kind of framework of verisimilitude, I'd say that one of the things that you're doing when you're writing an action scene, whether it's in science fiction or a spy thriller, no matter how high or low concept it is, one of the things you've got to think about is the rules to your world.
That's true.
Because there are things that you go into your world with, your speculative world of fiction. And you make an agreement with the reader to suspend your disbelief for these things.
Exactly.
And so that's really got to play out in any kind of action sequence. The rules have to be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if your character's got, like in Rogue Destiny, your character's got a kind of magic gun, it's got limited bullets. Bullets are expensive. Once the bullet's gone, it's no good.
It can't be like your standard, RPG or first-person shooter where bullets are unlimited.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just let that go, you sacrifice a lot of tension, you sacrifice a lot of opportunities for conflict, which I guess is what you need to drive any scene forward, whether it's action or otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So your rules have to be ironclad. Your rules have to be there at all times. And it's different from medium to medium, If you're reading something like, a Superman comic book or something like that, you've suspended a great deal of disbelief.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you're looking at an action sequence in, say, Die Hard or something like that, that's very gritty and real, at least in Die Hard 1, The guy doesn't have shoes on and his feet get cut because of it, and that's a big problem.
Yeah.
It's not just shrugging it off like a flesh wound. It's a real limitation for him,
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, completely... down another path here is what makes like the later Die Hard movies so disappointing.
Yeah.
Because suddenly Bruce Willis is jumping on the wings of a fighter plane and hanging on, and stuff like that.
Talking about suspending disbelief. when you've established a franchise can get people to believe anything.
See, I've suspended my disbelief for James Bond to do that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I've made the deal with the Die Hard universe that no, if you don't have shoes and you step on glass, your feet are messed up. So those rules have to be real. To your readers and to your characters. And I think, characters, obviously, just a huge part of any action sequence or battle scene or whatever it is. You have to think about your characters kind of through a different lens, I'd say.
Yeah.
When it comes to an action sequence than when it maybe comes to dialogue or something like that, right? So when you're really looking at this action sequence or this battle scene or whatever it might be, you've got to say kind of what unique qualities does each of my characters from each side of the conflict bring to this fight, right?
And so, that's a great point because it's not about necessarily just your protagonist and what they bring to the table. There's an emphasis on all individuals in the scene. I mean, even if it's random thug 3 versus random henchman 4 in the background, sure, they have to bring something to the table in order for it to be as believable as possible.
Yeah, it's all got to be in play. You know, I mean, we're talking about like physical, mental, and kind of emotional qualities of these characters, yep, and how they function in the framework of an action sequence or a battle scene or something.
Yeah,
like
given
that.
For example, things like heightened adrenaline, you know, they sure become the more, you know, maybe for lack of a better word, more extreme versions of themselves. Their strengths
that's
are
interesting.
Their strengths are maybe played up more. Their weaknesses are made that much more. They're made much more vulnerable by their weaknesses in those moments, maybe too.
Yeah, yeah, you know, if you look at something like, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here in this story, but like something like the Expanse series, right?
Sure.
Where you've got Holden, who is always kind of trying to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's a big limitation,
yeah,
when it comes to a violent confrontation.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you've got a character who's willing to do an underhanded thing,
mm-hmm,
you know, that's another interesting thing to play with. If you've got a character who's going to crack under the emotional and pressure of the sequence, that's also something interesting. You know, how does their biggest, baddest gun in the universe function in this scene?
Yeah.
And how can it be negated and stuff like that? So
yeah, absolutely.
You've really got to kind of think about all those different angles of your characters and how they could be used to your advantage as a writer in
yeah,
an action sequence.
For sure. Absolutely.
Huh. Oh, and then, you know, when it comes to the characters still, you've got to talk about, of course, their motivations, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one thing that's important, especially like in a battle scene, is that everybody thinks that they're fighting for the right reason.
Yes.
Right?
100% agree.
You know, everybody thinks that they're the good guy in the fight.
Villains for the sake of villainy is, you know, you can get away with that in something really, if you're writing something kind of campy, or if you're writing in certain,
sure,
you know, certain types of media, but generally speaking, I would agree. If you're writing a novel that's meant to have fully fleshed out characters, even the villain must believe they are the good guy.
Yeah,
they have to have a reason for what they're doing.
Even the most, you know, horrific, incompetent monster has to think that he's making America great again, right?
Yeah, there you go. There it is. It didn't take, what are we at? We aren't just at the 7-minute mark, and there we are.
But nobody thinks they're the bad guy, you know? Well, so you've got these two sides to any kind of action sequence or conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
They've both got to think they're the good guy in some way. They've both got to have goals that are fundamentally at odds,
mm-hmm,
against each other, right? Yeah. And then, you know, both sides just can't get what they want. So however this thing shakes out, you know, somebody's losing or both sides are losing,
yeah,
in this action sequence.
Someone, there has to be a step taken backward by one party or both by the time it's over.
And a step forward by one party.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a step forward for one party, I suppose. I suppose both sides could come out losing.
Slightly behind.
Sure,
yeah,
sure. Which is an interesting angle.
And you probably see that play out in different dimensions too. Because, I mean, when you're looking at confrontation between two characters, though they might both be, you know, fighting for control over the same thing, if they both don't get what they want, what are the losses that are incurred? You know, there's,
right,
there's difference between emotional loss, there's physical loss, there's,
mm-hmm,
all sorts of different dimensions, mm-hmm, to explore. So you can have both individuals or parties walk away from something not having accomplished their goal, but having suffered very different dimensions of loss, which opens up a lot of opportunities as a writer to explore those avenues as well.
And I think maybe, you know, I think maybe that's maybe the last core element of this action sequence. You know I said a verisimilitude, characters,
mm-hmm,
and setting. I think maybe motivations and stakes and consequences could be a fourth and a fifth core element, really.
Yeah.
Those are so deeply involved with characters, of course.
They're really embedded within
that. It could be a subsection of those.
Absolutely.
But stakes and consequences, you know, each action sequence or fight needs to kind of change the trajectory of both the characters and the plot.
Yep.
So there's got to be real stakes and consequences for action sequences.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, looking at those three things, I mean, is really the core of any action scene. I guess when you yourself as a writer are trying to set up a scene that you know you're going to write, what's your preparation like? Aside from obviously, I don't know, maybe you make a list of what those items are going to be, that of those three components, you're saying, hey, what's my framework? Here's a list. What are my characters? Here's a list. What's the setting I'm going to work with? Here's what I need to know about it. Do you do sort of a list thing? Is it you kind of just balance it in your head? I mean, what's your strategy that you employ before you sit down and write something like that?
You know, I think by the time I'm writing an action sequence or a fight scene or something like that, I've got my characters and their unique aspects, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of internalized.
Yeah.
You know, you should really know your characters better than anything else in your book, in my opinion. You should really be able to know what they do in any situation, how they react in any kind of danger. But I think that the first thing I kind of do is I would outline a battle sequence or a fight scene or an action sequence is to first understand the goals of the opposing sides, kind of as we described, you know. Why do both of these sides think that they're right?
And how far then, as an extension of that, how far are they willing to go to achieve them? Because that'll give you a real bird's eye view of how extreme of a confrontation we might see.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, are they willing to die for this? Are they willing to kill for this? Yep. Both?
Yeah.
Neither?
Mm-hmm.
Let's find out, right?
Super fair questions to ask. Yeah.
I think you also need to understand the outcome that you're going to need to serve the larger story.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you go into this conflict, right, and you know that you're going to be coming out of this and your character needs to be going in this direction. So how do you achieve that kind of outcome within the framework of the verisimilitude that you've built in this world, in this speculative world? Yeah. So those are kind of the first two things. And then I would kind of map out what I'd call the big beats of the fight, right? So you've got kind of the pre-fight tension where maybe, you know, this is kind of the gunslingers with their hands twitching towards their pistols, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And they're both kind of maybe trying to de-escalate, or maybe one's trying to do it without violence, or the other one's goading someone on, you know?
It's an Alexander Hamilton versus Aaron Burr. Let's have some words before the gloves come off.
Right,
exactly.
You know, it can make it more interesting, you know? Or maybe someone's just creeping up, ready to ambush someone. It doesn't necessarily have to be something like that, but something to kind of build that pre-fight tension.
It's the lure, I guess. It's the sense of mystery that you create in a reader to indicate to them that, yes, something big is going to happen here.
Sure.
We just aren't... You don't always start in media res, for example. You're not going to just start, all right, here it is, the battle's already happening, and then backtrack to what led to it necessarily.
Well, you know, to think about my book in Rogue Destiny, there are parts where there's a lot of exploration through some kind of suggestive environments, you know, that are saying that there's something up ahead that's very dark and dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, makes it all the more powerful when you do open that door and see the threat behind that dark door.
Absolutely.
So there's an element of pre-fight tension that you're going to want to establish, I think, in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, when you get into the action sequence, right, and you've got these two sides, essentially, you're going to need to have, like, an opening salvo. So somebody's going to need to act first. And you're going to have to understand their motivation to act first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, perhaps the reason they act first is because they think the other person is just about to act.
Yeah.
You know? You know, perhaps they are just biding their time until something falls into place, and then they act.
Yeah.
So some kind of an interesting opening salvo, and that's going to prompt a response, a reaction, a counterattack, whatever it might be. Now, this can go back and forth, right? This action, reaction between the sides of your conflict here.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, every conflict has to have a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's always kind of drawn from those character aspects that we talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
It can also, I guess, do with the environment, but it's got to have a turning point. You know, unexpected is best, of course, to really take it in a different direction that makes the reader say, oh my gosh, they went there, or makes the reader feel smart because they're like, oh, of course.
Saw that coming.
Right.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, so some kind of an unexpected turning point, and then obviously some kind of a resolution that kind of sends the plot and the characters off in a new direction.
Absolutely.
Things
should not be the same once you have... I mean, once any scene ends, that's true, but especially after a scene with high, you know, physical or mental confrontation, the last thing you want is for everyone to walk away in the exact same position they were when the chapter started.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that happens, guess what? You probably didn't need to write the chapter.
Yeah,
or at least you don't need to include it. I mean, there's a lot to be said for, you know, writing things that hit the cutting room floor, so to speak.
Oh,
I mean,
there
are opportunities to really learn more about your characters and yourself as a writer. But at the same time, if everyone's in the same place when it ends, it doesn't need to be in the final copy. Exactly. Nothing. And then nothing happened.
Waiting you know, and that is such a hard thing to do because you've written this amazing action sequence, and if you find that it doesn't impact the plot and the characters, it's really hard to cut that because you're like, my words, my beautiful words.
It's the classic,
no.
I know, it's that kill your darlings mantra that everyone has to struggle with. You know, I'm, You know, I'm struggling with that. You know, current work in progress. We all do.
That's what it is. That's what it is.
Absolutely.
You know, I should probably say that in all that kind of outlining of the big beats and everything like that, I always find that it's helpful to leave room for kind of organic development, for things to happen as you write.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes that's when you come up with those great turning points. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you think about it and you're like, man, this character's motivation here just does not make sense. I've got to work on this, you know? Or, you know, sometimes you'll write something and you'll say, there's no way anybody's going to buy this. And you get it in front of the writing group and everyone says, oh, yeah.
No, that was cool.
I was into that.
That was my favorite part. Yeah, exactly.
And you don't know how, but it somehow it works.
And you just let it work itself out. And that was, I was going to actually ask a follow-up about how, you know, when we're talking about, for example, a structure in which you have, beginning with the opening salvo, into a response, and there's sort of like a back and forth, the idea of trying to find ways to keep that from getting, you know, stale, so to speak. Because what you're, when you really think about the natural evolution of a battle or some sort of showdown, I feel like the tendency would be, or at least it would be very easy to fall into the trap of punch, you know, player A throws punch, player B throws punch. Sure. And what do you do to avoid that? Would you say that one of the best ways to avoid that is to leave yourself that wiggle room rather than, you know, give yourself that outline start to finish?
Well, you know, I think that that is one way to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to leave yourself room for that organic development. Unfortunately, the thought of organic development can backfire on you as well, because what if you organically come to the same conclusions that you did in the last fight, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that you really have to look at the differences that are involved. Mm-hmm. You know, what's different about this particular fight scene or action sequence than all the other ones in this book, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it's probably in a different place, you know? There's a good chance it's involving different characters in the conflict.
Yep. You hope so anyway.
Well, you know, I mean, that's often the way I feel these things go, you know, as James Bond goes through the movie. He doesn't fight the same guy six times. He faces him maybe twice, you know, once in the middle and then once at the end of the movie or whatever.
You have your, there's the main baddie, so to speak, and then you've got the baddie laddies along the way. He's got to get in fist fights with or whatever the case might be. And throughout the movie or, you know, if you're reading the books, it's not always just James. You might have someone that's, you know, alongside him to kind of be involved in the scene too.
Right, and that can help him or hinder him.
Exactly.
You know, if it's someone he's got to protect, he's in a very different position than if it's just James Bond tearing up Venice, you know, causing millions of dollars of property destruction.
Exactly. You're talking about, and it's not only a matter of even expanding on that. It's not necessarily a, do I need to protect this person? It's also a, do I trust this person? You know, having the idea of unsure allies is a really big component and a great way to introduce conflict for your protagonist. I mean, if they're going into any sort of confrontation, whether it's a high stakes battle or a tense meeting with other individuals, if they can't trust the people that they believe to be allies, I mean, they're essentially, you're taking something that was originally a good versus evil conflict into a good versus evil versus uncertain conflict that can really throw the direction of the entire scene and therefore your plot in a totally different direction.
Well, I mean, betrayal is a potent sauce.
Sure is.
Maybe should be used.
Thanks, Theon.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Maybe should be used, you know, lightly, sprinkled on lightly.
Yeah. But
yeah, it is definitely something that, you know, if someone betrays your main character in every action sequence, you might want to rethink your plans here.
It's going to tell you a lot about your main character. Right. What it's going to tell you
and
is
probably about
doesn't
yourself.
Have very good just, yeah. Not very good decision making. Right. If your character lets themselves get betrayed in every scene, they've got some deep evaluations they need to make about themselves.
Say.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Yeah. Well, that's all really fantastic stuff. I guess when we're looking at all of this, you know, again taking a more bird's eye view, we've talked about that framework. We've talked about characters. And I know you mentioned setting was the third major component. So I think for me personally, when I think of the thing that allows you to introduce the most, let's say, you know, freshness into a scene is going to be that change of setting. Because imagine how different a battle is between the same set of characters with the same set of rules if they encounter one another on, I don't know, a bridge versus on a life raft versus in the middle of the woods. I mean, setting is a huge, huge component of what you're about to see unfold on the page or on the screen. So how do you, when you're, you know, setting one of these up, how much thought do you really put into setting? Do you ever find yourself setting up the scene with, you know, one environment and then later on deciding, hey, maybe something else would work a little better?
You know, I feel like the plot that I have in mind, you know, that's already pretty firmly sketched out by the time I'm writing any kind of action sequence, mm-hmm. is dictating that setting to some degree, you know? Yep. I mean, hopefully I've developed interesting settings, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of my goals, you know, to create fun worlds to read in.
And that is, I mean, you know, just to give the shout out, because I think it's important that it be done. I think that's one of the great assets that something like Rogue Destiny has, is there are a lot of opportunities to explore a diverse number of worlds within a galaxy that, as readers, not so much of a spoiler alert, I know it's on the back cover of the book, but we ultimately learn, I mean, this is the galaxy in which we live now.
Absolutely,
so we're getting this opportunity to see so many different places and see how these different individuals evolved in those environments. And that creates just a plethora of opportunities for tension on the page in any one of those places.
You know, science fiction and kind of space opera, space fantasy in particular, I think, one of the great joys of writing that is writing settings,
yep.
you know, in a weird way, creating these worlds. A while back, I worked on a post-apocalyptic novel, and I wrote 500 pages of it, and I ended up abandoning it because...
Yeah, that's right. I remember you talking about that.
Yeah, you know, because honestly, it just wasn't fun. Everything was bleak and gray, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And sand and, you know, broken trees and dilapidated. And it just wasn't... I don't know. There wasn't the sense of adventure there to me.
The setting didn't breathe in the same way that it does when you have a galaxy at your fingertips.
Well, I'll tell you what. The setting felt like it was on fire for the first, you know, 200 pages.
Which it probably was, literally.
Post-apocalyptic. In some ways it was.
And that's not to say, and at the same time, you know, we've seen a lot of really successful post-apocalyptic stuff. I mean, look at something like, whether it's the comics or the show, The Walking Dead. I mean, that's been immeasurably successful in a very post-apocalyptic setting.
I love the Fallout games, you know what I mean?
For sure, those are great.
And those are games that fill your TV screen with greens, like dark greens and grays and browns, you know, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, to me, just writing that wasn't as fun because of the settings. Also because, like, there wasn't an element of fun for the characters so much.
I mean,
this is a completely different topic, but it wasn't an element of fun for the characters because, well, it's post-apocalypse, man. Nobody's having a really great time, you know what I mean?
Yep.
It's not really appropriate to crack any jokes right now when people are starving all around you. So I wasn't having fun writing it, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's brutal to write.
But, you know, back to action sequences and fight scenes. It's usually important. Setting's usually important, both in terms of creating kind of that verisimilitude and in terms of the fight mechanics of what's going on in your fight, right? So your setting really needs to be a physical presence so that the fight doesn't feel like it's taking place in empty space.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like on that video game, you know, 8-bit video game screen, you know, I'm picturing in my head when you talk about player A and player B punching each other, you know what I mean?
It's not, your fight scenes shouldn't read like Pong plays.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, so there's got to be things involved that they're interacting with, avoiding, you know. It can tilt the battlefield in favor of one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's maybe some cover to hide behind.
Mm-hmm.
There's some implements that someone can use to attack the other person.
It's the classic, I mean, it's the fictionalized version of a battle at Bunker Hill in which by having taken that high ground, you give yourself an advantage,
sure,
so to speak.
Yeah. Sure, mm-hmm. sure. You know, it can also add an element of peril maybe for both sides. You know, that fight on the catwalk that we were talking about earlier, you know, that we touched on. That can be a really interesting thing that almost becomes like a third kind of side of the conflict, I think. And, you know, the environment can, you know, has to feel present on the characters, but it can present you with a lot of different ways to come to that interesting turning point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe somebody uses something from that environment to give them the edge in a really creative way.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's, you know, grabbing a handful of sand and throwing it in someone's eyes or...
Yeah.
collapsing something or, you know, whatever it might be.
Classic Jorah the Explorer throwing sand in people's eyes while hanging out with the
Corsair. Right, yeah. You know, there's plenty of sand around. Might as well use it to your advantage.
Might as well use it. Why not? Here we are.
So, yeah, it just, you know, it should really be like a third character or a third side, I should say, to your conflict.
Well, and you think of it this way, too. I mean, using another historical example, because history, you know, obviously in a lot of ways informs fiction. Think about an event like D-Day. the beach, the water, the weather on a day like that. I mean, that is a third. And, you know, I feel like maybe fictionalizing an event like that might make it seem as if it's being trivialized to the individuals that maybe lived it, but it's really not. I mean, your characters battling against the elements is just as strong of a source of tension as it is for them to be battling against a, you know, character that is an antagonist, so to speak. So I think that's really, you know, that's important to keep in mind. We see that all the time in real life, where real life environments become a third character in an environment that was already rife with tension.
Well, you know, you want to talk about, if you consider Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, if you consider the opening where they do storm the beaches.
No, I haven't actually. I've got that on my shelf. I haven't read that one yet.
Oh, man. Intense. Yeah. Absolutely intense. That is great because, I mean, you want to talk about pre-action sequence buildup.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are gambling and smoking and drinking, and they're not sleeping. They know that they're an hour away from getting on those. I'm going to use the wrong term for the boats, but those little boats as they went.
Yeah, right.
Terrible.
I would say the same thing.
I didn't have that example prepared, but
yeah.
But you know, that's a great example of pre-fight. Mm-hmm. Speaking of fights, your cat's going to town on my ankle
my
here. Get out of here, cat.
Oh, he likes shoelaces. Great, come here.
Oh, man.
Get him out of the way.
Ken and I have different goals here. I want to do this podcast. She wants to kill my shoes.
Right? Exactly. There we have a conflict between characters and the setting of, you know, being at a dining room table and the shoelaces dangle. Cat will play.
But back to what we were saying.
Yeah.
The Naked and the Dead, that's a great example of the emotional aspect of that,
mm-hmm.
the setting, how that's coming into play,
mm-hmm.
The way these guys respond to the pressure, you know, the equipment they have, the high ground that the opponent has, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything's there. That's some real stuff right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
and I think when we're looking at setting, I mean, obviously that's a real-world example in which you are perhaps constrained by the fact that you want to keep things, you know, resembling the world in which you've written. But again, turning it back to something like sci-fi or space fantasy, space opera, what have you, that's where you really get that breathing room, because you can create that in advance.
Oh, sure.
You know exactly what you're setting yourself up for, what you're setting your characters up for.
Yeah. Writing's a lot easier when you make the rules for the world.
It is, for sure. I actually had and I'm going to try not to spoil anything for you here, because I know you're a beta reader for my current work in progress. But near the end of the book, I have a scene that I had to write at a port in a real life, you know, American city. And so I found myself saying, okay, cool. I've never been to this city.
Sure.
I have never been to this port.
Sure.
How do I go about setting myself up in such a way that it remains true enough to life, but also gives me room to, you know, speculate? Because we're talking about a future world here. And that's actually where I hopped on Google Maps.
Yeah.
And I did the street.
Absolutely.
I did the street view, and I quote unquote, you know, I air quotes walked around the city to try and get a feel for it, sort of thing.
Oh,
and
you know, it's that kind of thing that makes me feel lucky to be writing in 2016. You know, because
thank God.
I mean, I would hate going to the library for 4 hours to dig through everything that I needed to find that when it's at my fingertips now. I mean,
I
can't imagine. You know, you really had to do your research. You really had to be knowledgeable about something. Right now, the answers are at our fingertips.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it changes the game.
Yeah, it does.
I can't imagine going to the library and being like, hey, so I know we're here in Madison, Wisconsin, but I'm looking for an atlas of Austin, Texas. What can you do
for me? Right, exactly.
I guess what I'm looking at. My scene isn't Galveston, but, you know, generally.
You might have to get on the phone, call people
long
distance and
call
ask
it,
them
call
what's
in
favor there.
I need to speak with a dock worker.
Yeah,
Galveston,
right,
please.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
rough.
So I think when we're looking at, we've obviously talked about the elements that are really critical to creating a scene of your own. Do you have some examples of, if you were to make recommendations, I mean, writers, TV, movies that do a great job writing, you know, not just like that one great climactic scene, but also consistent quality moments of action?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, to go back to the Expanse series again, you know, I think they have a lot of great action scenes in there. Some of them are, you know, hand-to-hand combat.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are armed conflicts between two groups. Many of them are kind of starship battles, right? And they're very good with all of them. The writers are just fantastic. You know, you've got all those things coming into it when it comes to the characters' unique qualities and motivations. So Holden, in always trying to be the guy who does the right thing, you know, it limits him and it strengthens him in different situations. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To be underhanded can be a great advantage, as Game of Thrones teaches us, right?
As Baelish teaches us time and time again.
Right, and as Ned fails, as the Starks fail to learn time and time again, right? Yeah, well. You know, but somebody who's honorable, who is always trying to do the right thing like Holden, can also rally people to him.
That's true.
So it's a double-sided sword,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
You've also got, you know, like their ship, the Rocinante, right? That's got its unique capabilities. You've got Alex the pilot, who's really a unique pilot in how far he's willing to go and how hard he's willing to push a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then one thing that I really admired the Expanse series for is their use of gravity in everything that they do, right?
I didn't talk about that before, yeah.
So, you know, if your ship is traveling, there's thrust gravity, right? Mm-hmm. If your ship is not, you know, you're weightless. If people are unsecured when the ship is attacked and they're weightless, they can be in for major injuries, mm-hmm. you know? All these things are in play. The environment is very present in all of those scenes.
It's that setting is the third character.
Yeah, very much so. You know, another side of the conflict always.
Yeah, absolutely.
So those are, I think, really well done, you know, both in terms of the hand-to-hand, which is very gritty, to the armed conflicts, which are always very interesting and very clearly written,
mm-hmm.
which I think is an underrated thing in fight scenes. You have to be very clear about the juxtaposition of your characters to each other and to their environment.
Absolutely. I feel like it would be really easy to, and this is coming from a guy who doesn't normally write that sort of high-flying, those sorts of battles, I guess, mm-hmm. but I feel like it must be extremely difficult to find ways to prevent those scenes from getting muddled. You know, if you have a series of, you know, try to imagine this. I mean, imagine the raid on the Death Star being, and I'm sure it is somewhere, you know, written down in a novelized form. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing to be able to communicate that visually, but it's another entirely to try and provide the scope of a battle while also keeping it clear and giving your reader something to focus on.
Yep, absolutely. You know, and often the solution to those things, if it's unclear, if it's muddled, is to simplify.
Yeah.
As it is time and time again in writing, right?
Cut.
Yeah, you know, just make it simpler.
And at the same
time, say what you're trying to say.
And at the same time, you know, we're talking about making things simple. We're talking about cutting to make things concise. But in those first drafts, you know, you've got to give yourself that room to breathe. You've got to give yourself that time to explore.
Oh, definitely.
It's always easier, regardless of whether you're writing an action scene, anything, to write more first, cut and shape later. I mean, that's for me personally. That's how I feel. But I just never limit yourself on that first draft, I feel.
Well, you know, a person once told me that, you know, to commit to doing crappy first drafts,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's the fear when you're facing down the white bull and you're all by yourself, you know, and there's nothing on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just start going and just say, you know what, I'm going to write something that just sucks. I'm just going to get through it.
Yeah.
You get to the end and you're writing with energy. You're having a good time because there's no pressure.
Yeah.
And you get to the end and you're like, this is not bad. Yeah. That happens again and again, you know.
At least you hope so. God.
I mean, yeah, well, yeah.
Once in a while you write something and you say, at least I do, I go, well, we're going to restart that chapter tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow's the day. Let's come back with this with some clear eyes and see what we can do. You know, it's funny you bring up Star Wars. I actually had that in my notes as well. You know, I think Luke versus Vader in Empire Strikes Back is mm-hmm. probably my favorite fight scene of all time in any medium.
Yeah.
You know? That one's so fantastic in terms of how it plays within the framework of the world they've created.
Yeah.
You know, the Force, we understand it at this point,
mm-hmm.
and it's on display for us in really interesting ways. You've got this fantastic setting up in Cloud City, right?
Mm-hmm.
That comes into play from the Carbonite Pit
mm-hmm.
to the catwalks that the fight ends up on. Hell, Vader's even throwing like speaker equipment at Luke at one point or something like that. There's like big amps flying at his head,
absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
So that's all in play. And then the motivations of the characters
mm-hmm.
are so interesting there in terms of you're trying to figure out why Vader is so obsessed with capturing Luke, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Luke is there to save his friends. Such a noble ideal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it comes around to this turning point where Luke loses a hand, you know? Mm-hmm. The hero's not supposed to lose a hand.
That's not how this normally works,
and
no.
Vader, you know, makes the greatest reveal of all cinema history, maybe next to Michael kissing Fredo, I knew it was you. and then a really interesting thing actually happens in terms of the motivations of the characters. you know, Vader's motivation is revealed in a very interesting way. And Luke, his world, his identity is turned upside down in that moment. And then the environment that one moment ago was imperiling him, he was almost about to fall into that pit.
Yeah.
He's like, no, that's that pit. That's the lesser of two
evils.
That
might be better.
Right,
yeah,
that's
right?
where I'm going.
And that really is, I mean, that scene and everything you've described, I mean, that speaks perfectly to those three main components of that. Because if any one of those were changed, if any of those were less fleshed out, I mean, you're looking at a completely different situation. And there's a reason that scenes like that, there's a reason why Luke, I am your father, is what it is. And it's because it's that turning point in a scene that was done just perfectly up to that point.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, favorite fight scene of all time, right?
There it is. Got it. We covered that one too.
That's right.
So, and then that being said, I mean, when you have fantastic scenes like that, it's really easy for individuals that are writing their own material, whether you see it on television, whether it's in a novel, what have you, it's really easy to start falling back on some of those things. You know, there's a reason that the word cliffhanger contains the word cliff and hang.
Right, yeah,
and it's because you see something like that. You know, you have Luke hanging there, etc. I mean, how does one, when they're writing a scene, what's your strategy personally to try and avoid overplaying those tropes or overplaying stock moments that you see in fiction all of the time?
Well, you know, I mean, there's you know, a lot of stock moments, obviously. You know, you try to avoid those. There's, of course, the perfect kind of pre-fight speech, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where somebody rallies his troops, and where does that come from, right?
Yeah.
That's probably, like, goes back to Shakespeare and Henry V rallying his troops at Agincourt, you know, with this speech about, you know, how great they're all going to be regarded. And so, you know, we do want to emulate these things that we've seen that have become part of, like, our narrative, our hero's narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy for that to become stale. You know, another thing that's easy to become stale is the perfect line before the killing blow.
God,
right?
Yeah. God,
you know,
help me.
I mean, how many times have we seen that?
here's a good one though too that I think kind of contrasts with that, which is think about something like 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Sure.
When Hal is being unplugged. There's not like a final moment, as far as I can recall, in which, you know, where Hal is being unplugged, where he's like, you know, there isn't an hasta la vista, baby. It's just this very quiet, slow death of Hal with the, what are you doing, Dave? Like, just the slow falling apart that kind of turns that on its head, because Dave doesn't have to say anything. Hal knows what's going on. Like, that's it for Hal.
What's the perfect Corny line for him to say right there? It's time to defrag or
something like that.
It's
like,
time to unplug or cut the cord.
Time to take your mission offline. And, like, think about how cheesy that would be. That would be terrible. But instead you have just, like, this great dramatic moment where they do away with the trope of hasta la vista, baby, and they turn it into just this, like, it's almost, I mean, when, for me at least, here we have the antagonist meeting its end, and I'm still like, wow, that really sucks for Hal. Like, it grants a totally different set of power to that to that moment, you know?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is it is kind of context dependent, you know what I mean? If somebody is watching, you know, Fast and Furious 6 at this point, right?
Yeah.
Or another Bond movie or something like that, you've signed up for some of this
expectations
stuff, right?
Are very different.
And you are looking for that, and he says something, and the theater cackles. And
exactly.
So, I mean, when the reader, the audience, is in on the joke, is in on the fun, you know, it's maybe a bit of a different thing. You know, I do love Bond movies, you know.
Yep.
I have to say the Roger Moore ones are my least favorite. Because that's Bond at its campiest, you know what I mean? And those lines there are hard for me, you know what I mean?
To
enjoy. You know, it's interesting too, though, because it is about the character that's carrying it off. You know, Sean Connery could throw someone into a pit of electric eels and say, shocking.
Oh, God.
And Connery's so damn cool. He can carry it off. You know what I mean? It's cool. Really, you know. So it is dependent on the context in some ways. But, you know, as far as overcoming these things, right? You know, I think that often the way that this is done best is kind of through inversion, you know? So if you think back to Empire Strikes Back, right? When Luke's going to go off to Cloud City to face Vader, you know, Yoda doesn't give him this Agincourt speech. He doesn't, rally him with this sense of valor.
You can do it.
Right.
Yeah.
He says, don't do it. He says, you've got to learn harmony, man. You've got to learn to go with the flow. You don't do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting, I think, take to say, you know, our sensei here is not saying, go get him, Tiger. Yeah. He's saying, do not do this.
And acting against the advice of a trusted mentor is a very, that's a big deal. Because if you've written your mentor right, so to speak, that's going to be a big red flag. I mean, for your character and for your leader too, because your mentor should be the one that knows better than your protagonist.
Right, especially when your mentor can see visions of the future, apparently, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's a whole thing.
might want to take that into account,
yeah,
Luke,
you'd
but,
think so.
You know, only cost him a hand, so he's lucky, yeah, I guess. You know, similarly, when it comes to kind of the inversion of that perfect killing line, you know, I think that the Pierce Brosnan bonds did that in some really interesting ways.
Sure.
You know, there was a lot of inversion, I think, with that iteration of Bond, in that it showed kind of Bond as a older, sophisticated killer who used this kind of glibness to cover up what must be a pretty traumatized core to this person, right?
Sure.
I mean, he's been killing people for a long time.
Yeah.
Seen a lot of people die on his watch, you know? And so there's vodka, and so there's the arms of a willing woman, right? But towards the end of The World Is Not Enough, for instance, when Bond gets to the top of the tower and he sees Sophie Marceau's character, she's about to launch the nukes or whatever it was at that point, and he's got the gun on her, and he's telling her not to do it. And this is a woman that he felt a connection with, that he felt, you know, closest knew an affection for.
Mm-hmm.
He's holding the gun on her, telling her not to do it. And her hand's creeping towards the switch to throw it. And she says, you wouldn't shoot. You wouldn't shoot me. You'd miss me.
Hmm.
And he shoots her and says, I never miss. With this kind of sadness, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then he goes and kind of touches her face, you know, to further undercut the double meaning to I never miss. I never miss anyone and I never miss any target,
yeah,
right?
Wolf, yeah, there's power in that.
Which was, you know, I thought an effective inversion of that killing line trope, and you didn't cheer when it happened.
No,
you know, it brought forth kind of another layer to this traumatized person. You know,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm probably the only one who looks at Bond that deeply, but
I don't think that's true.
So
I have an uncle who swears by anything that's ever come out of that series, and that's great. I mean, it is amazing that you can have something that is written in such a every one of those movies, every one of the books has the same thing going on in the background, but they all manifest themselves in enough different ways that it remains engaging. And I mean, that's just a testament to, I think, what the power that you have at your disposal as a writer, the power that you have at your disposal as a creator of any kind, is to be able to take these core elements, like the ones we've been talking about today, and make them play out in ways that remain unique and diverse enough to remain entertaining.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Great.
It's about doing something new.
Yeah, nothing like it. And speaking of things that are new, segue.
Oh,
segue.
Another great segue.
We did it. Of course, as I mentioned at the start of this podcast, you did publish, that was still this year, right? Rogue Destiny was early this year. Was that end of last year?
Nope, that was April.
That was in April. Okay,
yes.
So that was very much this year still. So
I've made tens of dollars off.
Tens of dollars, friends.
Yes.
He is a Sammy Writers Group bestseller.
That's right. Meet me at the dollar store.
Meet him at the dollar store. Meet us at a Room of One Zone. We hang out there for our group. But Dan did, of course, publish Rogue Destiny earlier this year, and in the spirit of looking at some of the things we've talked about today, he was going to read a prepared selection from Rogue Destiny, and then we'll, you know, have a minute or two to talk about the elements that we've discussed previous to this and how they sort of play themselves out in that scene. So before, you know, you jump in with the reading, why don't you kind of set us up with
sure.
this, give us a feel for the story in a very general way, and we'll kind of take it from there.
Sure. So Rogue Destiny, very much a space opera, somewhat of a space fantasy, but definitely in the realm of what most people consider science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a galaxy-trotting tale, if you will. Bit of a space archaeology angle to it.
Yeah, absolutely. There is that, yeah.
And kind of your misfit crew running amok through the stars,
getting,
you know,
into shenanigans, yeah, across the galaxy,
having a bad time.
And I say this as someone who, you know, I'm biased. I was a beta reader. I was fortunate enough to have a chance to read this before. It is the published version that you see today, but it is really the things that really speak to me most in it are, there are a lot of really memorable moments of action. The worlds that these characters visit are great. You know, we talk about it in our writers group. We have, for example, Madeline and her story with Gorgo. Nothing better happened to Water Legs, right? You know, exactly.
Right.
Honey Legs,
right.
Excuse
right.
me, Honey Legs. We can't have anything happen to Honey Legs.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
in your,
yeah.
and in your story, we have, you know, Rubio. Great, awesome, misfit character. He is. I was always worried something would happen to him. And maybe something does. I don't know. You'll have to read the book to find out. But,
you know, it's funny that you pick out Rubio in particular, the sarcastic kind of robot that they got rolling with him. I found, you know, as I got to the end of writing this, you know, 700-plus page tome, that I became just as attached to the ship,
yeah,
as I did to, yep, the characters. You know, mm-hmm. It was really another character in the story and the setting of many scenes of conflict and action.
And it's obviously a super important thing to your protagonist, Zach, as well, is his relationship with the Space Rogue, as it's called, and what, you know, just kind of how, as they find themselves in different environments and getting in different misadventures, his,
sure,
relationship with that ship changes, but it's always a constant. You know, it,
yeah,
needs to be there. It's,
I mean,
it's part of them.
It's his home.
Yeah.
And it's the home of his family that he's kind of brought to the ship. You,
yep,
know what I mean? So,
absolutely.
Yeah, very much a character. Okay, so this is right at the beginning of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Zach has come to a snowy little mining colony to apprehend some wanted criminals, cash in the bounty, and basically keep his people fed and his ship afloat.
Sure.
At this point, he's confronted them in a small tavern, and he's holding his hex gun on them. Now, they think that they're fine because they've got magnetic shields on that he can't shoot them, and he is going to display exactly how cocky and arrogant he is right from the get-go here.
Let's do it. It's page five. It's a character-defining moment.
That's right. And let them know that, no, in fact, they are not safe.
All right. Let's do it.
Here we go. The Gigakin on the left stepped forward. We've bought and sold guns from this backwater hole all the way to the galactic core, and we've never seen a hex gun. It's a myth for senile old men, little boys, and stupid, weak Tellurians that believe in magic. It's not a myth, Zach raised an eyebrow, and it's not magic. See, when you fire a hex bullet out of a hex gun, the reaction, well, let's just say that it hacks the code of reality, just like hacking a computer program. And that makes strange things happen. Things your magnetic shields can't protect you from. Shit, bellowed the big one. You're speaking Tellurian shit. Zach continued as if he had not heard him. The kind of hex bullet I've got in the chamber, it's called an Inky. A scaly gangster sold it to me last time I stopped by Hollow Rock. I really can't wait to see what it does. Zach winked and pulled the trigger. What happened next had a kind of violent sensory poetry to it. A spinning hex bullet blazed out of the gun with a report that sounded more like a cannon than a pistol. As it entered the shallow, invisible field generated by the Gigakin's belts, the mag shields emitted a powerful magnetic burst that would have deflected an ordinary bullet. Instead, the hex bullet exploded with a great whoosh and filled every cubic inch of the bar with dense black smoke. For some reason, the smoke had no smell and felt as easy to breathe as oxygen. Zach quickly holstered his hex gun and pulled the iridescent spectrum goggles up over his eyes. After snapping their setting to infrared, he could see the thermal outlines of the three Gigakins drying their guns and Jarno stumbling around behind the bar. Bartender, Zach barked, get on the floor! The three Gigakins opened fire in the direction of his voice, and the mag shields built into Zach's belt did its job against their ordinary bullets. Two rounds ricocheted off him. The mag shield could take up to 10 bullets in a row before it burnt out, but neither the blazing pistols nor the sparking deflections added a shred of light to the room. As Zach ran at the fugitives, he reached into his belt and withdrew a bladeless metal hilt, his neural knife. When he slid the dial on the hilt, an 8-inch violet beam of energy hummed out. The energy blade was no more solid than a ray of sunshine, but it could inflict just as much pain on the nervous system as any real weapon. Zack's first swing went straight through the nearest Gigakin's outstretched arm. The one-eyed outlaw dropped his gun and screamed. To him, it felt like the neural knife had severed his arm between the elbow and the wrist. As the disarmed Gigakin fell to the ground, clutching his arm and shrieking, the other two scrambled for the door in the darkness. One turned the right direction, but the other, disoriented by the impenetrable darkness, came charging directly at Zack. Zack could see him clearly enough with the help of his spectrum goggles, but he barely had time to thrust up with his neural knife before the brute collided with him. Luckily, his thrust came up under the Gigakin's chin and jammed the intangible blade into his brain. This instantly disrupted his brain function and knocked him unconscious, turning him into 300 pounds of dead weight that all came down on Zack as they crashed to the floor. It wouldn't have hurt so much if it weren't for the cracked ribs Zack had brought home with the previous month's bounty. As he groaned and tried to push the drooling Gigakin off him, the third member of the Three-Eye Gang found the door.
And there you have it. The third member of the Three-Eye Gang finds the door.
That's
right.
What
happens next? I don't know. Pick up on page 7 of Rogue Destiny by Dan Spiro. So, great. I mean, that was a really fantastic opportunity, I think, to look at the roles that things like that framework of verisimilitude, characters, and setting play in an action scene. I mean, you have the framework, which is being established at this point. I mean, we're on page 5 through 7 here of this novel. We're talking about the neural knife. We're talking about the hex gun. We're talking about, you know, the fact
the spectrum goggles.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. I mean, we're really getting set up with the equipment here. So there's that framework. We've got our characters. We're talking about Gigakins. We know that that's a race that exists out there in the universe that Zack finds himself. We get to learn about Zack and, like you mentioned, his arrogance and that cockiness. And on the setting, you know, we're in a bar and we have that moment where he needs to tell the bartender to duck. Bartender's a good guy. Zack likes the bartender.
Sure.
Why wouldn't he? So, I mean, that's a really, I think this scene gives us a lot of great opportunities to see all the things we just spent that time talking about.
I think there's probably, you know, instances too of the environment in play there. I mean, Zack actually changes the environment to use it to his advantage, right?
Yeah, there it is. Yeah.
And you know, you've got Zack's cracked ribs from the previous month. You know what I mean? That he's still dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, that's kind of a built-in pain point for him in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you know, it's just a small taste of the action you can expect.
Yep.
But there you have it.
So thank you to Dan for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ryan. This has been really fun. You know, anytime you want to have me back, I'm definitely willing to come and crush some beers and talk about writing.
Crush some beers, talk about writing. It's
That's
Saturday
right.
in Wisconsin, folks. So
That's right.
This is what we do.
That's right.
We gotta get ready for, you know, the Packers to fail miserably tomorrow again.
Oh, God. That's a whole other podcast right there.
I'm not ready for that. Anyway, thanks again, Dan, and we will see you next time on the R.R. Campbell WritesCast. Be sure to check out the blog at rrcampbellwrites.com, where you can find new posts every Friday full of new writing tips for you to put to use in your own work. You can also join the conversation on Twitter at trollinlinguist. That's TROLLIN linguist. There's nothing like improving your writing by speaking with other writers about what it is that they do to improve their craft. So I hope to see you on there. And as always, until next time, write on.